following program is closed captioned for the thinking impaired.
Welcome to Logicast.
Yeah, me too. I'm not a fan so far.
I almost want to sort of like minimize this window. Okay, I think that might work. All right. Hello and welcome to Logicast. Logicast is a weekly, bi-weekly, semi-weekly, have we decided what it is? I don't know. Podcast where we discuss topics like philosophy, history, science, religion, politics, economics, basically anything and everything that myself and my wonderful co-host, Darby Eleanor Macy, decided to talk about. So this week we're going to be interviewing Daniel Gallotta, who is a budding scholar who was just who's about to start his master's in at Yale. So he was recently in a debate on the Miami Valley Skeptics podcast with my favorite person on the planet, David Fitzgerald. And they argued and discussed mythicism. This afternoon, I will be appearing on the God Theory podcast, which is our good friend Jeremiah's podcast, to also talk about mythicism and atheism and problems with it in the secular community. So, Darby, how are things?
Pretty good.
I have to say, I'm very proud of us that we got to this point. Because I know we've been talking about doing a podcast for a while that was recorded and not live.
Yeah.
So
it's good.
I'm very happy. I don't know how professional I look with my my Captain Morgan hat on, but I had a rough night last night. So.
Did you? I'm sorry.
Yeah. Well, it's self-induced. I had a little bit too much to drink. I know that that probably surprises you, but it's true.
Oh, wow. I'm sorry to hear it.
My brain is incredibly sorry to hear it, too. It's, it's sort of like walking through a smoky bar. You know what I mean? Like it's just, yeah, that's what it feels like.
Well, I was camping in Eastern Washington until yesterday night, so I was walking through a smoky bar. The whole place is on fire.
It's very clever. It is very clever. That's funny. Well, I didn't realize that upper middle class white people from Seattle went sort of camping. So that's refreshing that that still happens. What?
What?
What? I didn't know
that. Pacific Northwest is all about that.
Really?
Although I prefer not car camping, to be honest. I'd rather backpack in somewhere because then you have less people screaming, woo, at 3 a.m., which is so tired this morning.
Wait, car camping?
Yeah, where you drive into a campground and set up a tent with other drunk people and their truck and their music and their puking in the bushes, that kind of thing.
Yeah, down here we just call that normal camping.
Oh, okay.
I'm kind of moving my camera. Okay, there we go. It's a little bit better. Okay, so we're going to go ahead and get Daniel on here. Is there anything in particular that sort of annoyed you this past couple weeks? Because, I mean, there's been a lot of shit going on, but I guess we're going to get to at least one of those issues.
Yeah, we can talk about all that later.
Okay.
2 weeks of annoying crap during the, you know, early Republican clown car, so
yeah,
that's a lot.
All right, well, let me go ahead and get Daniel on. Hey, Daniel, how you doing?
I'm good, thank you.
Hey, we by the way, I listened to the show, and I'm gonna get to some specific points. Dude, you did a phenomenal job for like your first real mythicist debate. Man, you blew it out of the park.
Well, thank you. I think one of the things that was a little interesting to me is that, ironically enough, for a topic about the existence of Jesus, we didn't really talk about it all that much, which I found interesting. It was more like a discussion where David and I would give answers on our views of Christian origins more than the existence of Jesus. So I found that an interesting difference.
Yeah. You never quite got to the debate topic.
Well, it was almost like without even getting into it, we agreed to disagree from like from the first second, and just went back and forth. And I mean, I think the issue is that I'm not a Christian apologist, so.
Oh right, so he didn't have his regular stuff didn't really work on you since you're not making any of his arguments.
Well, I mean, I don't want to speak for David out of turn, or make comments that misrepresent him. But I think that's he realizes that I'm not the enemy, and I know he's not the enemy. And it's the fact that this topic is framed in those ways is problematic. So the fact that it was polite and what's the word I'm looking for? The fact it was polite and open and friendly, I think did wonders for, you know, everyone's temperaments.
I definitely don't think that it was an aggressive conversation at all. Unlike when we had David on our show, you know, and I
it wasn't aggressive. It was spirited. And I think the truth is, of course David mostly debates Christian apologists. So it makes sense that his arguments would be framed to, I mean, that's sort of natural, I think.
Yeah.
People that care about this subject a lot, aside from the scholars who, you know, don't.
One of the things that David said, he talked a lot about secular historians and saying that he even at one point made that, and he caught himself and said that he knew it was a provocative statement, but he said that secular historians are really the only ones doing any work. And my mouth almost drops like from my
David said that?
Yes, David said that during that cast with Miami Valley Skeptics. And
I
was completely flabbergasted. I could not believe that he said that, and I think Daniel almost had a heart attack too.
I don't get it. He didn't even like to admit that those people existed. I mean, not that he denied their existence, but he certainly didn't bring them up on purpose.
Right. Basically, David's comment, as far as I can remember, was that he only pays attention to secular historians because Christians are too busy circling the wagon. And I did take some umbrage to that because...
Yeah.
When I look at my bookshelf and I look at all the names staring down at me very intimidatingly with their very big volumes, honestly, I couldn't really tell you what most of these people do on a Sunday morning, whether they go to church or don't go to church. And
because they're doing history.
Well, yes. That and some of them. The other point I raise is that some of them don't do anything on a Sunday. Some of them go to synagogues earlier in the week.
Mm-hmm.
This isn't just a field divided by atheists and Christians. There's also Jewish voices, and there's also people who you wouldn't know if they were atheists or Christians. They don't engage in podcasts like this on any degrees. I mean, there's plenty of people I know for a fact who are religious, and they're doing wonderful work. One of my favorite scholars who I have no problem bringing up is Chris Tiering, and he just wrote a book called Paul's Divine Christology. And Chris is Dr. Tiering is a wonderful human being, and I know he's a faithful person, but he's doing some cutting edge work on Paul's views of Jesus. So is Larry Hurtado. I strongly disagree with a lot of the things Dr. N.T. Wright disagrees, but he is such a powerful voice in scholarship that he needs to be engaged with. He commands that much influence, and he's that talented of a scholar. And beyond that, there's also, we need to acknowledge that much like there are multiple denominations of Christianity, there are multiple wings of scholarship. There are liberal scholars, progressive, conservative, Roman Catholic. Like, my favorite historical Jesus scholar is a Roman Catholic, but you wouldn't know it really, apart from once you get out of his preface. And in his preface, he says that he would not write a book on the resurrection because he thinks the resurrection is a matter of theology.
And well, it is. I mean,
yeah.
Who argues historically about that? It's not really a historical topic. It's a theological claim. So the whole idea that, like, somehow you can't do this discipline, this academic discipline, because of what you do on a Sunday. Now, of course, there are some people who are in, you know, at Bob Jones or whatever, that aren't going to do real scholarship, but those people aren't showing up at the historical symposium in the first place. The idea that you can discount somebody because they're there based on their work.
Right.
And that's the part I don't get. You can't just go, oh, I'm not even, screw your work. You know, you're religious. That's, and what are they circling the wagon against? I don't understand.
Right. It's the thing I would point out about the more conservative evangelical wing of scholarship. It's very noteworthy that they don't typically appear at AAR, the American Academy of Religion, or the Society of Biblical Literature, but rather they go to their own conferences and their own seminars.
Right.
And but then having said that, some of those seminars are really interesting. And even within the realm of evangelical and more conservative scholarship, there's even subsections amongst that where there are evangelical scholars. For example, a fellow Australian of mine, Michael Bird, who does appear at SBL quite frequently, and Douglas Campbell, who is at Duke University, for example, who is an out-and-out evangelical. And he's always at SBL and AAR. So, you know, even within the more conservative realm of scholarship, there are still people engaging in the mainstream. But the problem I find is, and this isn't even just a mythicist issue, this is how non-religious, atheists, agnostic skeptics view biblical studies, is that it's very easy to categorize this as Christianity as a whole versus the rest of us free-thinking, rational people, and it's just not the way the field is framed at all.
That doesn't seem...
Just to jump in here real quick, Darf, you know, one of the biggest problems I have with this entire conversation is this idea that being an atheist necessarily makes someone objective, right? Like, just the act of not believing in a God somehow magically means that you're an objective agent, and I think that is preposterous. I mean, any and every ideology, and you know, that exists, you know, by definition, sort of promotes their own line of bullshit, their own line of bias. You know, you find this in political ideologies, religious ideologies, anti-ideologies, you know, like the anti-theistic movement, which I sort of sometimes engage in provocative ways. But, you know, one of the things that David, I've repeatedly heard him say, and I've heard these claims get made, is that thank God the atheists are here, because now we're coming to protect your science and to protect your history and, you know, and I mean, to protect your skepticism. And I'm like, there are so many things inside of the atheist community that get touted as fact, like that all wars were caused by religion, which is just fucking absurd and silly. And historically inaccurate, woefully historically inaccurate.
That one's easy, and yet people will still try to argue with me about that as if it's just, you know, true on the face.
Yeah, or that got mit uns, you know, on the belt buckles of German soldiers by definition means that Hitler was a Christian.
I'm like, right, yep.
It's a complicated question to answer from a very complicated character in history. So, you know, I mean, it's so unfair to just point to like these small little things and then go, well, that's enough proof for me. And I think that a lot of times I've asked people, mythicists, repeatedly, if there was a contemporary, does that by default mean that Jesus, you would consider Jesus to be a real person? And what they always say to me almost always is, you know, essentially no. That's not going to change their opinion. And I'm like, so why do you spend so much time arguing over this point?
Yeah.
It's been repeatedly and consistently debunked by people who are actually practicing history as experts. And Daniel, go ahead.
I just find it interesting that it almost becomes like a Doubting Thomas question. Like, unless I see the wounds and put my fingers in his side, I won't believe. It's... do a sermon on it, ironically enough, but it does remind me of this doubt, of this level of skepticism where no one and nothing is trustworthy anymore, and it does become difficult as someone who has a blog, who is trying to communicate with people like yourselves in the lay audience. And I'm always careful to say, that's why I ask people to introduce me as a budding scholar, because I'm not there yet, and I don't claim to have enough expertise to represent the academy by any stretch of the imagination. But as somebody who is in the academy, who is currently engaged in scholarship far more than the average layperson, as someone who's going in considerable amount of debt to...
you're paying for that. It's serious.
Yeah. I just wish people would... maybe not wish people, but it does become a bit disheartening when my word means absolutely nothing. And it becomes even more disheartening when someone who I admire very much, like Bart Ehrman, his word also means absolutely nothing, and it frames it in a very difficult way to even have conversations, which is why I think my discussion with David was helpful, because we could at least talk openly and candidly which is something that I think has been lacking from this discussion.
I think that's part of the sort of, especially American movement toward people just deciding that their opinion is just as good as anybody's, as if expertise doesn't exist anymore. So the, you know, the WHO and the NIH and the APA all say that, the AAP all say that vaccines are safe and effective, but, you know, I read these 5 or 6 mommy blogs, and they know because their neighbor's cousin got autism after the MMR. It's as if the idea, and then you say, but these people do this for a living, or these people study, like, these people understand this in a way that you don't. Like, I had an immunologist explain several things about how vaccines work to me in detail, which was so helpful. It's not something you can just find. Like, you can't just access that information very easily, especially in a way that's sort of accessible to a normal person. And the idea that, well, I read some of this stuff, and I know I'm a parent, so I must understand immunology and virology and, you know, everything. That is happening so much, and I don't know if this is happening in Australia or not. I mean, they did boot out Sherry Tenpenny, but in America, it's especially happening because people feel like their opinion is worth just, I have a right to my opinion, as if that makes it valid. Sure, you have a right to it. Of course you do. Go for it. But the idea that experts don't exist or don't matter, I don't understand that at all. There's a reason that people spend years studying something. It's because they actually do know more than you about that thing. And I'm not sure why people are threatened by that. I don't
there's also this issue of people saying that, yeah, these, you know, a person or expert A, B, and C are being paid off by, you know, this this entity that has like a conflict of interest, right, with regard to, you know, to objective study. But of
big
course,
Jesus, big pharma.
These people, yeah, big Jesus, big pharma. But of course, these people who are coming in to save the day with their objectivity, you know, and their skepticism and rationalism, those people are the ones without a conflict of interest, despite the fact that mythicism is being talked about in pretty much only one subgroup. And it's essentially the atheist secular subgroup. Like, that's the only place where we're having this conversation. And, you know, it's so frustrating.
Well, it's the place where the conversations become most dominant, because in my studies of mythicism, I'm actually not that interested in mythicist theory. I respectfully disagree with those people who do adhere to it, but I fail to see its explanatory power at all. And
right.
the leaps and bounds and force readings they have to put on to the text and the sources, at times, frankly, it baffles me. But on the other hand, I find mythicist reception history quite fascinating. Its birth in the 18th century with the Enlightenment, moving on into the 19th century, and then going on into the Dutch radical movement, and then being picked up in the Soviet Union, and then its reappearance in the New Age fort in the 70s and 80s, and now its reemergence amongst the atheist skeptic community, watching its evolution, much like the evolution of the quest for the historical Jesus, is fascinating in itself, moving from the stained glass Jesus and, you know, rediscovering that Jesus was a Jew after all the horrors of World War II and reconsidering Judaism and the New Testament. So much like how that reception history of the quest for historical Jesus is interesting, the quest for the mythical Jesus is also interesting to study, who these people are, where this movement comes from, and how they conduct themselves is quite fascinating.
Well, I mean, the biggest conflict of interest, insofar as I can tell, because obviously I think Casey, Maurice Casey, was most likely, he identified, I think, as agnostic, right, Dar? So,
he was a non-believer, he said.
Yeah,
Casey was, much like a lot of non-Christian scholarship scholars in the the particularly who grew to prominence in the late in the 90s and the noughties. Casey, like Bert and Mac, for example, were self-declared non-religious people, but they did not identify. Michael Gulda is another example. These scholars, because it was still very entrenched in, and it still is, entrenched in Christian circles, to be anything right. other than a Christian or a Jew was quite quite different. And typically, like the way they behaved, like you wouldn't see Casey or Gulda at places like Skepticon. In fact, Michael Gulda, who I another
not
scholar.
Not they would get invited anyway, but
why would they go though? I mean, I guess you might.
I can't comment for them
as a hobby, I guess. Not
right.
Part of work.
One of the things I find quite interesting is both Casey and Gulda identified themselves as non-aggressive. They prefaced themselves like that. Gulda, in his interview on BBC Radio, said that he was a non-aggressive atheist. And Casey said something
wow.
very similar. Yeah. And Casey said something very similar, that he was... He was not anti-religion. He was not, he would use language like that. And James Crossley, who was one of Casey's greatest pupils, he's very similar, that he's a critic, but he's not against religion. And I think that's this anti-religious expression we find ourselves, while it's not new, its provenance is new. Its vocalness, I don't think that's a word, but its prominence and how loud it is quite new, and we're still trying to figure out how to deal with it.
You know, let me jump in here real quick. There's a couple of thoughts I want to share on that. Number one, one of the biggest problems that I have with this whole ordeal is that religion is treated as, you know, the antithesis to human progress. Right, which that is necessarily historically inaccurate regardless. Okay? I mean, I think the three of us can agree that it's historically inaccurate to assume that religion has always set us back, right? I mean, but this is something that's truly believed inside of the more anti-theistic, sort of circles. And Darby knows because she's dealt with these people, and I know because I've also dealt with them. And whenever you explain to them that religion has its own problems, and I don't think that it's a good idea to teach children terrible things about their self-worth. But at the same time, there are a lot of other really large systemic issues that we face that have nothing to do with religion, or where religion is sort of like on the sidelines. It's tangentially involved, but not directly. There are a lot of other larger, much more impactful issues, and since you're not going to be able to eradicate religion by reasoning and being logical with everyone, and I don't support the idea of outlawing religion at all. I think that even suggesting something is preposterous.
That's crazy.
Anytime I hear someone say that, I'm like, fuck you, you fascist shithead, because that's exactly
what
you are.
Yeah, that's terrible.
Like, you know, if you think you can go around just controlling what people believe, I mean, you're a fascist, and there are atheists who believe that. I've seen
that word gets used all the time wrongly, but that's the correct way to use it. That is fascist.
I hold off on calling people fascists unless they absolutely fit the definition of it. And
yes.
That is most certainly one. So, you know. So
something I will comment is at the University of Newcastle, I got to do a really fascinating course on critical religion. And I was able to do a research project on Marx's statement that religion is the opium of the people. And something I found very fascinating, studied that, is how a lot of people use that phrase, that people see it at, because of drug culture, post-60s era, religion is understood to be this, and how we understand opium today, they read Marx as if religion is this dangerous narcotic that distorts
people. Not what he was saying at all.
That's not what it meant at the time.
And well, that's my point.
Yeah.
When I actually got into studying what opium was at the time and looking at the prior writings before that, that religion is the, you know, the cry of the oppressed and all that. That one of the things I found really fascinating is that religion is very good at finding the world's problems. It's very good at like, religion understands that there is a problem with the way we communicate. Religion understands there is a problem in justice. There is a problem with poverty. There is a problem with the way humans treat one another, basically. But the issue for Marx is that religion as a solution wasn't good enough. And that's, you know, in comes, you know, Marxism, socialism. But that's a different issue. But the thing I found really interesting is looking at religion in the modern world is far from religion being the opium of the people. I wish I could remember the source, but somebody said that religion is not the opium of the people, it's the heroin, it's the crack cocaine of the people. That religion these days does not make them dull opiates, but actually it makes them junkies and excited and motivated and energetic. And
it's the crystal meth of the people.
Yeah, exactly. And I found that very interesting on both the liberal and conservative wing that like when same-sex equality, marriage equality was happening, it was the religious right that was up in arms, motivated about it. But on the same time, there were these other churches that were celebrating it and like jumping up and down that they could be involved in this. So yeah. It's very interesting how religion doesn't opiate and turn them into just, you know, these delusional people, but actually motivates them and energizes them and excites them. And as someone who used to be religious, I can relate to that.
I do find it really fascinating how, and you're absolutely right about it, that it's now like crack cocaine, it's sort of crystal meth, right? Because, you know, it does. It gets people so fired up and excited and, yeah, motivated for sure. I think from my perspective, especially being in the Bible Belt and growing up in a very Christian conservative community, a lot of it is that people down here, for example, feel threatened by people like me. So because they feel threatened and because they feel scared of people like me, that's what causes them to get so motivated. And instead of it being, and I'm going to tell you, instead of it being like this happy, we want everyone to be happy, we want you to come to church because we love you, blah, 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 blah. Here it is very fire and brimstone, very angry, very agitated, very defensive, very in your face, very don't take my rights away, don't take X, Y, and Z from me. The world is going to fall, you know, crash down if I do not get my way all the time. And by you, even you existing and not believing the same thing I do, I perceive you to be a threat. And it really is touted this way inside of a lot of social circles in you know, the conservative world, which to me, I see people on the gospel left who are, you know, your Episcopalian liberal churches, for example, progressive churches. But then you look on the opposite side and those people are usually accepting and they're actually trying to preach this inclusive, you know, kind of theology. Whereas on the right, it's a very exclusive kind of theology. And not only that, it's angry, vitriolic, and, you know, these people will go out of their way to try to do whatever they can to get laws passed that will benefit their ideology and the way they interpret their theology.
Yeah.
I actually have a chapter coming out in a book sometime in the future about the leftist Jesus, the liberal, the Jesus of progressive left Christian denominations, and how what sort of historical Jesus scholarship that's drawn from. But sorry, a bit of self-promotion.
No, it's fine. I'll definitely be interested in reading that. Okay, so one of the, and going back, we've sort of segued a great bit, and I know you didn't want to spend the entire time talking about the debate, so I promise you I'm not going to do that to you. But
no, that's fine.
One of the things I wanted to bring up is that I put quotes in on my notebook, and in quotes I said, "I don't know what a forgery is," by David Fitzgerald. And I wasn't trying to be rude. Stop laughing, Darby. I wasn't trying to be rude. I was just like, he does not understand what a forgery is. Can you please put Josephus's interpolation into proper context so that we never have to have this conversation with people again?
Okay. Just for some further context, Josephus was a first century figure, Jewish figure, born in Palestine, born, I think, in the mid-30s, if I'm not mistaken. And eventually, the reason why he is very important is that he was involved in the Jewish War. That's when the Jews revolted in the mid-60s against Rome and led a quite successful campaign against Rome until eventually the man we know as Vespasian would basically squash Jerusalem and sack the temple. Josephus is important because he surrendered to Vespasian. According to Josephus, he had a prophecy, an unveiling, and he saw that Vespasian was going to become the emperor. Titus, I should say, at this point. That Titus was going to become the emperor. And Josephus was very useful to Titus throughout the campaign because he could serve as an interpreter, help out with the landscape, and he basically helped deliver. As you can imagine, he was grateful. Titus was grateful. So when he took Josephus to Rome with him, he gave Josephus a pension and some estate. And Josephus lived quite a comfortable life. Well, being someone with that sort of means, Josephus took it upon himself to write several documents, two of them that are very important to historians. One of them is called The Jewish War, which is Josephus's reflections and accounts on the Jewish War, and also a bigger volume called The Antiquities of the Jews, which is Josephus giving basically from Adam and Eve up to the present day, right through Moses and David, the whole history of the Jewish people. Now, within that bigger volume, Antiquities of the Jews, there is a very interesting passage that has divided scholarship called the Tessian Flavian. Flavian Tessian. So I'm getting tongue-tied over it. But anyway, basically, in the passage, it starts off that there was once, and at this time, there was a wise man called Jesus, if it is lawful to call him a man. As you can already tell by that, it's a very strange passage. And it goes on to talk about wonderful things this Jesus does, and that he's crucified by Pilate. But eventually, like those who loved him from the first did not forsake him, and the tribe of Christians continues to this day. Now, this section is obviously an interpolation or a fabrication of some kind. What we mean by that is Josephus did not write this. There's too much. Josephus was a Jew, and Josephus did not believe Jesus was the Messiah. In fact, he thought Vespasian was the Messiah. Fun enough. if you can wrap your heads around that. And so what scholarship debates over is how much of it is an interpolation. Is there some authenticity to this? And a lot of scholarship says that if you take away the Christian-friendly language, it does sound a lot like Josephus. Other scholars, however, point out the manuscript tradition and point out that no early church father knows of this passage directly. And the first time we get the inkling of it is from a guy called Origen in the fourth century, I believe, or late third, I can't remember. And he basically says outright that Josephus did not think Jesus was the Messiah. So some scholars deduct from that that maybe Origen was aware of this passage, but flat out says that, well, it's clear that Josephus doesn't think Jesus is the Messiah. But then Eusebius, who is the father of church history later, who inherited Origen's library, he is the one who first reports this passage as we know it, which is what makes some people suspect that he is the forger. In fact, there is a PhD candidate whose name escapes me at Duke University who is arguing this theory. It's an old theory, but he thinks there's validity to it. Now that I've rambled like this, I want to make it very clear that I'm not a Josephus scholar. I've studied Josephus in the background of my scholarship so far. And I'm undecided. I'm on the fence. I lean towards it being somewhat authentic because that's what the experts have led me to believe. But I have heard good arguments on the other side. So, yeah.
Well, there's that passage, and then there's one other one.
Right,
that is,
sorry.
Is not there's really controversial, but that the mythicists bring up as well, sort of
right.
conflating the two.
There's another passage, this time it's in the Jewish War volume, mm-hmm. and it refers to a certain man named James, or Jacob, as a, you know, same name.
Yeah.
And as far as we can tell, it says, you know, James, the brother of Jesus, which is really striking because in the ancient world, you were known as the son of somebody.
Son, yes. Right, yeah.
Yeah. So the only people in the ancient world who are brothers of somebody are if they had a famous brother, because that would help distinguish that. And Jacob, much like Jesus, Joshua, was a very common name. So when mm-hmm. we're talking about, you know, James, son of Jesus, we know who we're talking about here.
Yeah, because you can't just say brother of Joshua.
Right.
That's everybody. Like, everybody's got a brother.
Yeah, right. So what's interesting is that most scholars think that this is a very straightforward reading, and that it's clear that this is James, the leader of the Jerusalem church, in the 40s and 50s of the early church. Mythicists, I shouldn't just say mythicists, because there have been people independent who are not Jesus mythicists who have argued that this passage is problematic. There are some people, a certain French scholar whose name escapes me, thinks that the passage has been corrupted by scribes, and that it originally...
Isn't everything?
Well, basically, that it's not. This is not what you would call an interpolation with intention. This is an this is an accidental one where there was some sort of corrupted manuscript tradition, and a scribe reads it a certain way, but disagrees. And in his heart of hearts, it's like, oh no, this is meant to be James, the brother of Jesus. There are other scribes who see manuscripts and like, that can't be the case. And they, you know, in the Gospels we find that, but that's a different sort of interpolation, and it's important to distinguish the two. They argue that the passage refers to James, the brother of Jesus, Damius, I believe. I personally don't see it. I'm not convinced. Richard Carrier has made the argument that that's the way it is. He published a paper in Vigilani Christiani, which is a respectable journal, but I disagree. I don't think we find the manuscript as corrupted as he makes it seem like it is. I think a more natural reading of the text is James, the brother of Jesus, known as the Christ. I think that's the more natural way to read it, but like I said, I'm not a Josephus expert.
I've read that, and I've read arguments, specifically Carrier's argument, that you're referencing. For me, that passage is sort of... with all other corroborating evidence, I think that passage is not necessarily a slam dunk, but it's a really, really, really good indicator that, you know, that Jesus Christ was a real dude. I mean,
well, it's important to like I was saying in the discussion, none of these are like slam dunks that Jesus existed.
But I'm a layperson, not a scholar, so I can...
Right.
Leave the Christ out of it, though. We don't want to conflate those two.
Right, yeah, Jesus of Nazareth.
No, I wasn't. Yes. What I said... You got to go back and read the passage, Darb. We'll cover it later. Go ahead, Danny.
Okay.
My point is, one of the things I find problematic with mythicist theories, in all of their forms, and it's important to note that there are a variety, like a lot... ironically, mythicists complain about the lack of consensus within historical Jesus scholarship.
That is kind of funny.
Ironically, there is a lack of consensus. And on my website, I've broken down a few of them. For example, there's the fictional Jesus theory, where Jesus is literally a fiction who gets mistaken as history. There's the conspiracy theory ones where Joseph Atwell, for example, thinks that Josephus invented Jesus to pacify the Jews. And then there's the celestial Jesus, which is the celestial Jesus theory is probably the most popular one amongst atheists, which is the one first promoted by Earl Doherty, but has been picked up by Richard Carrier. But my problem, there are lots of problems, but when you go into the second century, for example, in the late first century, if these passages in Josephus and Tacitus and the gospel traditions we get, if they're all somewhat reliable, even if they're not completely 100% eyewitness accounts or whatever, these people are promoting Jesus as a man in history, as a Jew, like situated in a certain point in time, in recent memory.
A guy, yep.
Yeah. It's not as if he is a figure of the distant past like Hercules. He is contextualized in a very recent part of recent Jewish history, even within the Gospels. If Jesus lived roughly in the 30s, died, year 30, 33, and the first Gospel is written in the year 70, roughly, Mark, that's still recent history. That's still in the local memory.
Interesting.
And it's not a celestial figure. Mythicists complain a lot about the lack of contemporary sources, but something I find interesting is the lack of their contemporary sources. It's not like we have, for example, Pliny the Elder or Pliny the Younger saying, and there are this really weird mob, Jesus, who claim, like, there's this really weird mob of people called Christians who believe in this stupid superstition, who claim that a man comes and visits them only in their dreams. Like something like that. No, what we find is there's this weird superstition of people who believe that this guy who Pilate crucified in Judea is now a living God. Like, that's the story they're telling. They're not telling a mythicist story.
Yeah. What's interesting is that it's almost like a false dichotomy with mythicists, right? Because essentially what they're saying is, you know, I am basically, they don't believe that historians have met the burden of proof. Whatever the burden of proof is, they just seem to make shit up and just decide that this is what the burden of proof is now for, you know, ancient,
barely heard of
figures from, you know, from the first century who...
For classical historians, they suddenly have to go, like, these gates get automatically set up that usually bear some resemblance to modern science.
Yeah.
Yes.
This is how do you prove, you know, that this is true. And then they start making these weird straw man arguments about how, well, there's no contemporary, so obviously he didn't exist. Or, one of David's things in his book that I especially found kind of jarring is his whole, I mean, he's, I think, as you know, I think he's a funny writer. He's a good writer, but there's this whole list of people who should have, according to who should have been talking about Jesus. This guy who did healers and this hypochondriac who saw everybody. Well, the historical Jesus, that's not about healing. That's a theological argument, and we're back to that again. And so he's sort of dumping this avalanche of here's who should have talked about this great healer. Well, that's not really the argument. And besides, I don't understand how we're saying this should have happened in first century Galilee or whatever. Like,
I think it's interesting that, mythicists, I find anyway, it's almost if, because they're not engaged in the scholarship exactly, particularly lay people. I shouldn't even dump mythicists in this. Anyone who is a lay person who is interested in the historical Jesus, it reminds me a lot of the quest for the historical Jesus that was happening as from the 50s and 60s. Not that I was there, I'm only 26. Interesting is one of the early, like the second quest, when scholars wanted to go back to look for Jesus, it was the idea of finding Jesus without interpretation. that if we peeled back the layers and layers, if we got rid of the mythology, we would get back to a pure Jesus, a Jesus without interpretation. Jesus the photograph, almost.
Right.
Well, a lot has sort of changed because people like James Dunn, who was also a Christian, in his great book, Jesus Remembered, he and his pupils or those influenced by him, like James Crossley, like Chris Keefe, like Anthony LaDon, have talked about it's this misguided quest to find a Jesus tradition without interpretation. Every piece of history has interpretation. So we're not going to get back. We're not going to get back to videotape, as it were.
That seems like a strange thing for that time period. Why? What do you think? I mean, what would they think would be?
Well, it's interesting because a lot of it was motivated by liberal progressives and in the religious circles. So a lot of the idea was we need to get back to the authentic teachings of Jesus. So like many quests for the historical Jesus, there was a spiritual element for a lot of people underneath the surface. And that's not so much that there's the old saying that every historical Jesus scholar like finds Jesus looking in a well almost. It's very interesting that lots of scholars of historical Jesus past, their Jesus shares a lot of their values. And something I'm going to be pointing out in my chapter coming up on the liberal progressive Jesus is that the Christian left, for example, is anti-establishment, doesn't like rules, doesn't like regulations, doesn't like dogma, and the Jesus they produce is egalitarian, loves women, hates the temple cult and temporal sacrifice rules, and Jesus is imagined as giving God's forgiveness freely.
Right.
It's interesting.
You can find that stuff in there. It's like anything. You know, if you want to find wrathful Jesus, you can go through and do it. They love the money changers thing and the don't pray in public thing. I can't remember either verse. Sorry, guys. But they trot those out. And then you have the people who are just, oh, he was all about love, and then you can find a bunch of stuff there, as long as you ignore the rest of it.
Weeping and gnashing of teeth. Yeah.
Right. Yeah, that's what the war on error guy has been doing quite well, I think.
Everybody really seems to forget about the fact that Jesus told people that if you have, like, if your parents or your children don't believe that I'm the one, you need to basically excommunicate them from your...
Yeah.
Right. That's the impression we get. And also, Robert Mills from the University of Auckland in New Zealand has written a very good book on this, and talks about that the kingdom of heaven is great if you're in it, but if you're not in it really sucks.
Right. And he was pretty specific about not very many people making it in. You know, and he said few, right? Which that doesn't, let's even just say, as Ben Schultz does, let's just say that's 49%, right? So that would be few rather than more. Even that, like you're, and then he talks, you know, we have the eye of the needle and, you know, all of it. He really does go into sort of detail about how much that's going to suck, how thorough it's going to be, how difficult it's going to be. And then, if you read the stuff he says about it, you kind of, the group kind of shrinks and shrinks and shrinks. And then you have a little bit of a hard time if you're paying attention to all that, talking about love and forgiveness and da da da, you know?
Right.
So you have to be pretty charity picky.
Well, it's very interesting. Like, when you pick up the Jesus seminar, for example, if you pick up their book, The Five Gospels, where you see what they voted on, it's very interesting that pink, which is what they voted as authentic Jesus tradition, it's the very pacifist Jesus that they voted on.
Right.
And the apocalyptic Jesus is what they voted black, which means non-authentic material.
Wow.
It's a very interesting. Yeah. It's a very interesting time. That happened in the 80s, the Jesus Seminar. It's a very interesting time in historical Jesus scholarship. Like I said, like I said at the beginning of the podcast, the actual history of the historical Jesus is almost just as interesting as scholarly attempts to reconstruct him. Mm. But something I also want to point out now is one of the things with contemporary, the issue isn't so much whether or not Jesus existed. The issue is how much we can know about him. And if you pick up E.P. Sanders, who was at Duke University, who's now retired, but has a book coming out very soon, which I'm excited to get my hands on. It's his first book in like 10 years. So yeah, it's anyway. Mm-hmm. He wrote a book that was very influential back in the day called Jesus in Judaism. And in that book, he surveyed so much of historical Jesus scholarship to formulate some sort of consensus view, like what were scholars saying about Jesus and what could people agree on. And in the end, he comes up with 13 points. And that's like, I don't feel like people understand that those 14 points isn't a lot. Like the points, for example, we have Jesus was probably born in Nazareth. Jesus talked about the kingdom of God. Jesus was crucified by Roman officials. Like right. That's 3 points right there. And he only thinks most scholars could agree on 13 points of Jesus' life.
That's more than even the stuff I've read, but I'm sure the finer points are not that, like,
no.
Just that he was an apocalyptic preacher, which doesn't get mentioned in the like, really most basic, but that's kind of obvious, I think. So, yeah, right. 13 isn't that many, and you're right. It's not a very, the range of agreement on exactly how we can reconstruct this person as a character, you know, as a character in history. It's pretty narrow, but that doesn't, of course.
Well, the problem is we're dealing with.
Yeah.
The problem is we're dealing with a person who is remembered by his earliest followers and their followers, remembered as a resurrected, glorious Messiah seated at the right hand of God. Mm-hmm. So already we have, like, data is skewed from the very beginning. So it's quite difficult. But what we need to remember is without Jesus resurrected to the glory of the right hand of the Father, we wouldn't even have the historical Jesus. Jesus would have just been left to the ashes of history. It's only because his followers believe that he was risen from the dead and exalted that he's even worth studying.
Yeah.
Or maybe, just maybe, he would have been another paragraph in Josephus, and that's all we would ever know about him. It's because Jesus was resurrected, according to Christian belief, that he's even worth remembering. So, and that's something I think we need to like take a deep breath. And not only that, is Jesus, as far as we can tell from the earliest material, in my opinion, is a figure that only gained notoriety at a very brief period in his life.
Yeah.
For a very short period of time with a very... with a very limited message and died in a very harsh, quick way. Like, that doesn't... history is not made to remember someone like Jesus. Like, that's something... Right. Jesus was not a general. He wasn't a revolutionary who worked up an armed revolt. He was born... in a satellite community, most likely, couldn't read or write, never had wealth, and he became noteworthy at the very end of his life. Like, history is not made to remember someone like Jesus.
You know, what's really interesting, it would sort of be like if Darby and I died suddenly, and then our show was sort of like lost for 20 or 30 years. We had like a small following of people who were going around and, you know, but for the most part, the message had either been lost or was, you know, segmented to a very small portion of the population. And then 2000 years from now, you know, Darby and I are regarded by a large portion of society as being the two smartest people who ever lived. I mean, that's essentially pretty much what happened with regard to Jesus.
Well, we aren't trying to whip people into any sort of particular behavior.
Yeah, but the
well, I guess that's not true. We are trying to get everyone to vaccinate their kids. There are several things we're trying to do. Yes.
The irony of the whole situation is that he sort of saw himself as the savior of mankind. What's crazy is that there are 2 billion people on this planet who believe that. I mean, that in and of itself is just, it is so fascinating to think about that, that this guy, this illiterate, you know, Jew from the first century, you know, who was apocalyptic preaching dude, you know, believe that he was the son of God, has 2 billion people on the planet alive.
Yeah, I mean,
who believe the same thing.
It is sort of chilling to think about. I wouldn't mind not knowing who he is, but only from the perspective of not having to hear about it or have laws based on it, or, you know, I'm sure people would have found some other thing to believe, I guess, so maybe he's better than the alternative. That's a whole other conversation we could have if they're, you know, would we have to invent it if it wasn't that, or would everybody just be Muslim? I don't know, but yeah, he doesn't seem like the kind of guy that should, but somebody's going to, right? Isn't there sort of a element of luck in all this where it's like, you know, things are going to catch, you don't know why.
And well, like when we look at, you know, the thing I think we need to remember in this discussion is that despite what church history would let you believe, it's not like Christianity was this booming religion from the very beginning.
It slowly grew.
It evolved over time and changed, and with it, it grew in numbers. And but really, without the conversion of Constantine, I mean, things were set up for success. But who knows what would have happened if Constantine? You know, once you have an emperor converting to your worldview, and let's keep in mind that worldview Constantine converts to is not the Christianity of the first century. It's not even the Christianity of the second century. Like, it's important to remember that Christianity throughout these periods of history, especially at this point, is very different. But then when Martin Luther kickstarted the Reformation, Lutherans today are very different from it's important to remember that when Constantine converted, it's not like he was converting to the religion of Jesus. He was converting to Christianity at that time. And even that was very, you know, he became a Trinity. Yeah, you know, he was converted at that point and became a Trinitarian. And that set up things although he was baptized by an Arian, which was really interesting. But anyway.
Oh.
Many people know that he was baptized by a bishop who did not believe that the Father and the Son were one, but anyway.
You know, by the way, one of the things that Darby and I came across, a couple days ago, there's this guy from, he's a big contributor, he's a biblical scholar who posts on the subreddit Bad History a lot, right? And, you know, atheists, believe it or not, especially the atheism subreddit, winds up on our Bad History all the fucking time. And it's to this point, it's almost just a running joke there that, oh God, here we go. We have another atheist saying something historically illiterate. The funny part is that he goes, the question that this guy asked him as this other atheist was like, why do you think, talking about the criterion of embarrassment, he said, why would God need to be baptized? And I
this whole time it has never occurred to me. It blew my mind. I was like, wow, that's so true. Why?
Oh my God. I know. I was like, fuck, why didn't I come up with that? Because that is absolutely brilliant. And it's so simple. Why would I said resurrection to begin with, I meant baptism. But why would God need to be baptized? I mean, why would Jesus, if he was God, need to be baptized? You know? So I think that elements like that and arguments like that add a whole lot of credibility to the way that the scholars like yourself, budding scholars, communicate to lay people some of these concepts. You know what I mean?
Right. No, what's interesting is the criteria by which we do historical Jesus research it's getting a facelift right now. It's under examination. Anthony Ledon, and Chris Keefe have contributed to a book about the demise of authenticity, I believe it's called, Jesus and the Demise of Authenticity. And basically, them and a lot of other scholars, including people like Mark Goodacre, Zebra Crook, are pointing out the flaws in the way scholars have conducted the quest for the historical Jesus. So it's a very exciting time right now. We're currently retooling, you could say, in historical Jesus studies. For example, the criterion of multiple attestation. Like, mm-hmm. just because multiple people attested does not mean that it's more likely that it happened. Like, how does one prove that? Okay, so this source says it, and that source, like this source says that Jesus healed somebody, and then this source says that Jesus healed somebody, or this source says that Jesus walked on water, and this one says it too. They're independent of one another in this scenario. So did Jesus really walk on water then? Like, that, like, they're both independent, so it must be, you know.
Right.
So we're starting to rethink.
It's not that simple, for sure, right.
No, it's not that simple, but I'm trying to. But one of the ones that most scholars think that can be saved is the criterion of embarrassment, which is why would they come up with a tradition that's early in the Jesus strata? For example, the crucifixion. That's the Jesus was died, buried, and resurrected. Like, that is the chema. That is the first thing we get about Jesus
right.
from the earliest writer, who's Paul, who's like with the first Christian. So,
and
why
that's all that
they,
Paul really cares about, right? Is the resurrection, yeah. really, right? So
pretty much, he gives us a few other things like the Last Supper, the Lord's Supper, and mm-hmm. Jesus not liking divorce. But beyond that, there's not much.
Nothing to do with his own personal feelings about yeah. marriage or women.
Well, it's true, actually, because Paul rejects what Jesus says.
No, really?
Yeah.
Never mind. Go ahead. Finish.
No, that's fine. I'll make this point before I get into it. But like the crucifixion, it's why would you come up with that? Because it is so Roman in character, despite what someone like, respectfully, Dr. Carrier argues about Jesus being crucified in outer space by demons. It is so Roman in character. We know it happened a lot to messianic pretenders in the first century. We have lots of evidence of that. And we can clearly see Paul has to work very hard to make sense of it. And the early Christians carry it forward, and then it makes sense when we get to later Gospels that they have to, like, for example, in the early Gospels, we can see that Jesus suffers and is tempted to not go through with it. But then when we get to John, he embraces his cross willingly and has no problem getting crucified. And then when we get even further down the line to, like, the Gnostic texts, we have Jesus who can disappear off the cross and laugh at himself. And we also have a Jesus who has the ability to vanish as well. And also texts like the Gospel of Thomas, that gets rid of the cross completely. They clearly do not like it at all. So why would you make that up? But it also just makes so much sense within the context.
So explain the point about how Paul rejected Jesus' stance on divorce. I find this, by the way, what you just said was all fascinating, and we could sit here and listen to you talk all day. But I really want to hear about the Paul.
Me too. Paul, I don't have any idea about that.
So. Yeah.
Right. Okay. I it's funny because I actually did my thesis on this chapter for the University of Newcastle, but it wasn't about this. In 1 Corinthians chapter 7. It starts off very interesting that Paul changes gears. Paul's been on a bit of a tangent right now talking about unity and the body of Christ, how we all need to be unified. Chapter 7 changes gears, and chapter 7 says, "And now to the things that you wrote me, brothers and sisters." So clearly they've written to him with questions. And the first thing they ask about, shock horror, is sex. So they've clearly got someone's doing something naughty in between the sheets, and they're asking questions about it.
Of course, of course. Abrahamic religions and sex. I mean,
right. And they're having these problems about temptations and about self-control. But in verse 7, he starts talking, and I've brought it up. To the married I give this command, not I, but the Lord. So he's talking about Jesus. That okay. The wife should not separate from her husband. But if she does separate, let her remain unmarried or else be reconciled to her husband. And that the husband should not divorce from his wife. To the rest I say, the Lord and not the Lord, that if any believer has a wife who is an unbeliever, and she contests to live with him, he should not divorce her. And if any woman has a husband who is an unbeliever and contests to live with her, that she should not divorce him. For the unbelieving husband is made holy for his wife. And he goes on. But basically, Jesus is very – he basically says from verse 10 that Jesus was very clear, that the Lord is very clear, don't get divorced. And then as he goes throughout this verse, Paul starts putting parameters on that. Like, well, you know, but he distinguishes it himself, saying, not the Lord, but I reckon that you can, you know, be sanctified for marriage and things like that. It's quite interesting. It's quite interesting about how he
so
feels.
So he is sort of imposing his own thing that doesn't always agree, yeah. Right? That's, yes. Okay, that's what I was trying to say, and I got confused. Okay.
It's not well, like Jesus but that just may pop in and you know and be like, no, that's the wrong thing to do.
Right. You know, I mean, I don't know.
Paul's like, and well, some here's my disclaimer. I just say, not the Lord, by the way.
I don't know enough about this to. I've read a little about it, but
it's striking that even as soon as Jesus has died and supposedly resurrected, already. His followers are interpreting him. Already there are parameters right. Being, it's like, well, what did he mean by that? Like, you know, it's like, it did not take very long. and that's the thing I find very, and we can see that in the letters of Paul, for example.
Well, and this
the
is
debate
where...
about circumcision, kosher, like already, like day one, there are disputes. Like,
and I'm confused actually about the precise way that Paul got so much authority. Like, he ended up as the boss, you know.
Did he?
Well, I mean, it seems like he did, right? It gives him, like, why is everyone asking him questions?
That's a really good point. The problem is so much of our stained glass image of Paul, mostly put in there by the movies and Acts of the Apostles, is we see Paul as this, like, giant mover and shaker. But Elizabeth Fiorenza at Harvard University has done a lot of work on this, and a lot of people are being persuaded in the academic community that Paul is not actually the big deal he seems to be. When you start to read his letters from start to finish, you'll notice that he's always on the fringes. Like, for example, the fact that Paul has to say in Galatians that I did not get my authority from any man, but I got it from Jesus.
So listen to what I say because I'm bossy.
Well, it's not so much that, but like if somebody has to defend themselves by saying that I did not get my revelation from a human being, but I got it from Jesus, by mirror reading the text, it's quite clear that people in this community are saying, who's this guy?
Right. That's what I meant. Like, listen to me. You have to listen to me, even though they're like, I don't know, why should we listen to this guy? He keeps writing us letters, bossing us around.
Well, it's clear that, like, some of these churches Paul founded, or Paul was instrumental in their founding. But it's quite clear, one of my mentors from the Australian Catholic University, who's done a lot of work on this, he's done a big study on Paul, Jerusalem, and the Judaizers is his thesis. Very good book. And Dr. Ian Alma is his name. And he has done a study on counter-missionaries because it looks like in Paul's letter, wherever Paul goes, counter-missionaries are not too far behind him who are trying who are trying to counter what he's saying. And it seems, for example, Galatians and First Thessalonians are known as some of the earliest writings of Paul. There's a debate about which one came first. Most scholars think First Thessalonians came first. But in Galatians, he mentions a big fight at Antioch. And he's trying to keep this harmony that's spilled over from Antioch into the churches in Galatia. Now, Romans, on the back end, is known as the last letter of Paul. And notice when he says to send greetings, he does not say to send greetings to Antioch anymore. Paul is no longer welcome in Antioch. And then when you read some of his other letters, it's quite striking. The salutations he gives at the beginnings and endings of letters, it's very interesting what churches are missing. Douglas Campbell from Duke, his thesis is that Paul is prompted to write because he's in panic mode, because he is being kicked out wherever he goes. And that the people writing to him are also, because they support him, are also being kicked out to the fringes. And they're writing to him like, oh my goodness, Paul, what the heck? For example, in 2 Corinthians, Paul goes on this very big tangent about, am I not an apostle? Have I not seen the Lord? I sound like a madman, but you know, these super apostles, and he calls them super apostles in a very derogatory way. So clearly these people are apostles. They are emissaries of Jesus, but they're denouncing Paul. But notice what they're denouncing, and this is something David and I got into debate about. Paul and these apostles, I believe, would agree that Jesus was the Son of God. They would both say Jesus is the Son of God, but what they disagree is what that means in practice. Paul thinks it means the end of the age is upon us and the grand vision of God, that the Gentiles, the pagans, will be brought into the family of God, and we will all eat, you know, that great image from Isaiah and the Psalms, that we'll all eat together in the kingdom of God. He thinks that's happening. And because that's happening, he thinks the Torah, the law, is useless now. Its meaning is done. Its purpose is done. These guys clearly are saying, nope, Jesus was a Jew. Jesus was the Messiah of Israel. Jesus did not teach the end of the law. So you don't know what you're talking about. So they're not debating about Jesus. They're debating about practice. Sorry about that big ramble.
No,
it's fascinating.
It's interesting. I've only read a little bit about Paul, but I remember hearing.
If you would like if I can recommend a book to you, that's
please.
It's aimed at lay people, but it's designed for a bit more of an in-depth reading. Even though I don't agree with him all the time, In Search of Paul by John Dominic Crossan and Jonathan L. Reed is a really good way to sort of dip your toe into Paul. It provides lovely pictures of the geography. It has archaeological sketches. It breaks down a lot of what's going on in Paul's life and letters. And it's very enjoyable for lay people. I highly recommend it.
That's fascinating.
Cool.
It's a good start. In Search of Paul.
All right. Daniel, we've been running for about an hour and 20 minutes, so we're going to go ahead and close up. Fascinating, fascinating stuff, by the way.
Thank you.
Let me ask you this, just real quick. Are you really seriously done with the conversation, with the Mimesis conversation, for good?
Well, ironically, I'm talking to you about it, so technically not. The reason why I say I'm done is because, let me put it this way, I'm done trying to convince Mimesis they're wrong. If somebody wants to ask me what scholars think and how scholars interpret that and how I as a budding scholar interpret the evidence and what I think of mythicism, I'm happy to talk about it, like what we're doing here. I'm happy to convince other people why mythicism is wrong. I'm done trying to tell mythicists they're wrong, if the distinction makes sense.
Perfect.
So, because the reason why is the question of whether or not Jesus did not exist, I think it's a good question. I legitimately feel like it is a good starting point. This is ancient history we're talking about. This is technical and problematic sources we're studying here. It's a pretty valid question. The issue is it has a very, very, very valid answer.
Yeah, that's the problem.
Once you're done answering that question, it's not like, okay, Jesus existed, that's the end of the conversation. It's the next question I'm more interested in. And that question is, okay, Jesus existed, but how much can we know about him? How can we construct him?
How can we figure that stuff out, right?
Exactly, like, and the epistemology behind that, yes. That's where the real adventure lies. That's where the real tough mission lies. And that's where I'm heading. Like, I'm here at Yale to head in that direction, not waste my time trying to convince why mythicists are wrong, if that makes sense.
Yeah, and I, you know, when David asked, what are your problems with the mythicist argument, he asked Jared and I that question, which was a fine question, but the way it was phrased didn't really make sense to me. They're not my problems. I actually understand that I'm not qualified to have my issues that I brought up with him are not mine. They're the ones that, you know, the people who understand how to study it and can read things in the source language and can read Aramaic and can read German, so they can, you know, read other early sources. I don't have access to any of that stuff. Plus, I don't understand enough about first century Judean culture to get contextual things that are hugely important.
Even
so,
by David's own admission, though, he's saying that he's saying he's in the same camp we are. He's just on the opposite side, right? What he's saying is that none of these arguments are actually mine. All of these arguments belong to other people, and I'm just giving them out to the public so the public can understand what's going on behind the scenes. The problem with it is that there's no real scholarship in that wheelhouse going on, besides maybe sometimes Richard Carrier, rarely, and I don't know if Price really has done a whole lot of anything in the past couple of years. I mean, they get people like Frank Zindler, who was the former president of American Atheists. They get Earl Doherty. They get Murdoch. They get people, they get Fitzgerald, they get people who are in general not qualified to answer or have this conversation to communicate information they are not qualified to assess and already have wrong, to communicate that to the public. Let me finish real quick.
Yeah, sure.
Daniel actually sent me this really great video last week of Bart Ehrman basically explaining the importance of becoming a seasoned expert in your field before ever trying to explain the content of what you study to a layperson.
Right.
You know, because you have to have not only do you have to have an expert level of understanding of you know, your specific place in academia, but you also have to be able to be creative enough and intelligent enough to explain all those really hard and difficult and complex concepts to a group that usually suffers from literacy in your field,
right?
Basic literacy in your field.
And right, so, and you have to understand what they know and what they don't know. A lot of people, you don't even realize you may assume they know something, and you proceed with that assumption. That's completely wrong.
Ironically enough, even though I sent you that video, ironically enough, I'm on this podcast. this is actually important because it's a debate, a discussion rather, at this year's SBL, Ehrman and McGrath and a few other people will be on a panel talking about blogging and being biblical scholars and bloggers. And one of the things that's really interesting is that I have a blog and I love writing on it, but it's interesting the mode people perceive, and I'm always very careful not to say I'm an expert, but some scholars, and I don't know who exactly, or I don't want to name names as well, think it's very inappropriate for students to have blogs. Like, you're not an expert. You shouldn't put your information out there in a blog.
But you're not claiming to be. I don't understand. Like, it's not like no one should ever talk about it. I understand stuff about pregnancy that a normal person doesn't know because I've studied it. That doesn't make me an obstetrician or an expert, but I can talk about it in a way that most lay people can.
Right. There are some people who feel very strongly within academia that blogs being run by students are bad ideas for multiple reasons. I disagree, obviously.
I have a blog.
I think it's just important to wear your credentials or lack thereof on your sleeve. I think it's very important to own up to that. Own up when you're in the minority. Own up when, like, for example, I'm not the biggest fan of Q. I could be persuaded on Q as well. I went to a university that didn't really like Q, and now I'm at Yale that does like
really?
Q.
Really?
So, yeah.
Newcastle doesn't like Q, huh?
No, ACU doesn't like Q. No, the Australian Catholic University doesn't like Q. But Yale does like Q, so I'm very interested to hear the opposite side. But within that framework, it's interesting hearing someone like Mark Goodacre talk, saying, "I'm in the minority on this." Like, he does it politely and graciously, and it's not that everybody else are a bunch of cranks who don't know what they're talking about. There's scholarly disagreement, and that's the issue I find. That basically, it's almost this like biblical language where historicists, people who think that the historical Jesus existed, mythicists almost behave like, "Oh, if only they had eyes to see and ears to listen."
Right. You know,
and that's what's frustrating.
And there's a difference between. I mean, I've heard Ehrman talk about this in regards to Carrier. And Casey does in his book. There's also a reason that people have the sort of rules of behavior that you have in scholarship, so that you can continue communicating and you can understand each other and you can learn from other people's perspectives. You mm-hmm. don't start insulting them and accusing them of sleeping with their students or whatever. Instead, you address their points civilly and with a and that stuff. I actually don't understand why Carrier does that. He seems like a really smart guy. It doesn't make any sense to me.
On the air and say, because I, let the record show, I have a journal article coming out in which I will critique Carrier's work, and I'm terrified what he will say about me online.
Yeah, I know.
By the way, real quick, just to interject between you two, because we really do got to wrap this up.
Yeah, I know.
Daniel, I wasn't trying to imply, by the way, that the people that listen to you and that read what you like, me and Darby and Daniel Bastian and like other people like that, who are very, very interested in this topic, but we're far beyond the basics of this conversation. So, I mean, we are not the target audience of one of Bart Ehrman's pop culture books. Does that make sense?
Right.
No offense, obviously, to Bart Ehrman's brilliant, brilliant man, great historian, but you're on kind of a different playing field. But there's still little things, like the thing about Paul, that we had no idea. So I wasn't trying to imply that you shouldn't be blogging and going on podcasts, that kind of thing. You're not out there actively trying to, in my view, you're not out there actively trying to, put an expert opinion.
Right. I'm not trying to change a paradigm yet.
And you're not trying to claim to be an expert yet. That's the thing. Like it seems silly to not make a distinction between me and my last official history class was, I think, in Ireland, and it was the French Revolution in 1995, and you. Do you know what I'm saying? Not like there's zero and then Bart Ehrman.
Yes.
There are shades in between that matter. And I think what you said was really important. You have to say, these are my credentials. These are the limitations of my current knowledge or my current study. And then you work within those. You don't try to, fly out and that's the difference, I think. And then Yeah.
One of the biggest problems we had with David Fitzgerald, but there were two big points. One of them was that he was calling himself a historian. Now, he explained that away by basically saying that other people were giving him that title. I still don't think that that's a valid or legitimate argument or statement. It definitely doesn't excuse it, because if someone says that, you know, for example, I'm an, you know, I don't know, an expert businessman of some sort, you know, I'm going to be like, no, I'm not. You know, I mean, I'm going to correct them, because I wouldn't want other people to be misled by my experience and by my credentials, right? So that was the one thing that we got upset with David about. He still really hasn't stopped that behavior and told people, no, don't call me a historian, because I'm not. The second problem was that during his rebuttal to the meme that I made of him, which caused this whole conversation to get started, which, yes, was fairly rude. I showed it to you. You know, David nailed a, you know, peer review and peer reviewed. And I mean, Darby and I tore his ass up and down on the show over him making that claim. So, yeah. You know, so I mean, there's so much that there's a lot of ambiguity inside of that. There's a lot of ambiguity inside of the Mythicist camp, you know, with regard to credentials. And what they do is they do what every other form of pseudo scholarship in the world does. They have a bunch of amateurs that are out here, you know, that are out here communicating, you know, these topics they don't understand, that are coming from the one or two, you know, experts that they have in their wheelhouse, and, you know, and basically trying to obfuscate or obscure the importance of of going the whole distance and going on the journey of becoming an actual scholar. And that really pisses me off, and I know it pisses Darby off too. So anyway,
it's part of this very depressing, like, my opinion is just as good as yours because I've read A, B, and C. Well, you don't even know what you don't know. Like,
yeah.
And so that's the point. And I don't either. I don't know what I don't know. That's why when I read this stuff, I do so with interest and also understanding that I'm not going to get all of it. Of course I'm not. I don't have the background to get all of it. So, I mean, that's the big difference, I think.
Well, if you'd like to get some of it, time for some shameless self-promotion, you can...
All right, let's do it.
I say you can come to my website at www.danielngulotta.com, GULLOTTA, and you can follow me on Facebook, and I'll be happily keeping you updated on Facebook with the happenings and some new. I like to repost news articles, what my peers and my people who I really admire, what they're working on right now. So if you'd like to see what's happening in the world of scholarship, feel free to follow me. And I'll also let you know what I've got brewing up at Yale, hopefully. Hopefully something original, keyword original.
That sounds great, Daniel. Hey, man, we really appreciate you being on the show.
Thanks for coming on.
Yeah, we're
my pleasure.
We're both, to be honest, well, I can't speak for Darby, but I'm excited to see your career sort of flourish, to be honest.
Oh, thank you.
I really am. So, all right, man. Daniel Gulotta from About to Be. Will you start your first day tomorrow, don't you?
Not tomorrow. I start orientation on Thursday.
All right. Yale orientation. That must be awesome to wake up and look at yourself in the mirror and be like, I'm going to fucking Yale. You know what I mean?
it was a very exciting experience.
I would seriously be like, no matter what anyone said, I'd be like, yeah, well, do you go to Yale?
It's a good thing you're not going to Yale, Derek.
That's probably why I wouldn't get into Yale, uh-huh. is because I would use it as a punchline to insult people, you know.
Uh-huh.
So anyway, all right, Daniel, thank you very, very much. Definitely check out Daniel's website, danielngulotta.com. And we'll probably have you on at some other point in the future, Daniel.
I'd be very happy to come back.
Awesome. We always love learning about historical shit. So... All right. You've been listening to Logicast. We are on – well, wait. Damn it, Darby, you didn't tell me to change the ending. So now I'm reading off the script and it's all screwed up.
Sorry?
If you're listening to the show, obviously it's because we've released it. We haven't really set a schedule yet for when we're going to be releasing all of our, you know, the episodes, but they'll probably be coming out on Thursday nights as usual, or Thursdays, either in the morning, afternoon, or evening time. But we are still going to be producing a show every single week, working hard to make sure that we produce a show every single week, and continue to have the hard-hitting content and bloviating that that we're so well known for. So, well, me in particular, not really you, Dar. So be sure to check us out. We will have another episode posted very, very shortly. And you've been listening to Logicast. Check us out on Blog Talk Radio, logicast.com/blogtalkradio. Also, feel free to check us out on Facebook, facebook.com/logicast. You've been listening to myself, Jared Smith, and my wonderful, beautiful, amazing co-host, Darby Eleanor Macy. And we will see you next week.